opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Cyberspace is a place that only a human being locates, where there's so much information to take. There you enter an entirely new page. Once you get off the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Gold.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place.
Hotep, my name is Renoka Rashidi. I'm an avid fan of and a big supporter of Brother Junior Stanton.
And we started off our program with Desiree, Strengthen Your Mind. Apt admonition to learn and grow and to evolve, because we are living in serious times and we need all hands on deck. We need everyone to be about growth, personal change, self-actualization, and individuation. Not individualism, but individuation, which is the process of growth, development, and actualization of each and every one of our potential. You're logged on to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton, and we're getting ready for our guest, Mrs. Esther Iverum, who is a journalist, an award-winning journalist, in fact, poet, author, a radio producer, and co-host for a program on Pacifica. What's at stake? Her latest book is entitled We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006. It's available from DiCapo Press. And she's very interesting, very erudite. She's our guest today. We'll speak with her following these messages. Don't go anywhere. You're logged on to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com. Or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul at blakeradio.com as the email address and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's Ireland Place, Suite 109, Amityville, Amityville, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support. You're listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Stay tuned.
Our guest is Esther Iverum, who is an award-winning journalist. She's a film critic, she's an author, a poet, she's a movie reviewer and critic, she's the editor of Seeing Black, and she also is a co-producer and host of a syndicated radio program entitled What's at Stake. And as I said, she's the editor of the Black Portal, SeeingBlack.com, and they're celebrating their 10th anniversary. Welcome. After all these years, we finally got to.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You have an extensive bio, and you've done quite a bit. You're a very creative person. So share some of your background and history with our listeners.
Well, I was born and raised in Philadelphia. And, you know, it's very interesting because I found that even though I haven't been at home for, you know, like decades now, I live in Washington, I've lived in New York and L.A., I've reconnected a lot with a lot of folks in Philly. And that's one of the great things about being on the web. You're not really limited to one place. you kind of develop these connections all over, not only all over the country, but all over the world. I'm sure you must have the same experience, the same thing to some extent, in terms of the feedback you get on your various, you know, media ventures, your column and your show, that, you know, the web is just amazing, and it kind of can reconnect you with people you haven't seen forever and meet, you know, connect you with new people. But anyway, yeah, I grew up in Philadelphia. I wanted to, you know, be a writer when I was fairly young. I went to church with my mother, and we had to do recitations for Easter and for Christmas, and I started writing my own instead of doing the ones that they gave you. And that's when I really started writing poetry. And so I guess also with my name being Esther and it being a biblical name, that was also something that I was really interested in. So I remember writing something about Esther and the Bible and everything. You know, if I perish, I perish, you know. And so I remember that being some of my first experience writing. And I just kept it up. I kept a journal, and I, you know, I wanted to write. I think it was very influenced, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s by people like Vicki Giovanni, Gil Scott-Heron, you know, who just, you know, joined the Ancestors. I was just, you know, obsessed with them and their work because they played it on the radio right there in Philadelphia. And you heard Ego Tripping on the WDAS. We heard Gil Scott-Heron, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, and the Watergate Blues. I mean, they actually played those things, and I feel like really, you know, I don't know. I feel, when I think back, I'm so happy, actually, that I was exposed to those things then, and I don't know if you know, like, my child or children today growing up are experiencing, you know, witnessing that kind of like positive art on the, from the radio. A lot of what they hear is just kind of either neutral or, you know, negative. You know, but I was very, very interested in poetry and writing and all of that. So, you know, I graduated from public schools in Philadelphia. I went to undergraduate at USC, Southern California. I really wanted to get away from the East Coast. I really wanted to see something else. And my parents were very hardworking, working class people. And looking at their lives, I felt like if I didn't travel when I was in college, I had this idea that if I didn't travel when I was in college and I started working, I would just never be able to, like, do anything. So I went far away. I went to California, and that was my idea of, like, kind of getting away and seeing something else. Little did I know that one of the advantages of being a journalist is that you do get to see things. So I didn't have to worry about that, but I didn't know that as a 17, 18-year-old. So I went there for undergrad, and I went to graduate school at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism in New York City. So I was from L.A. to New York, and that put me back on the East Coast. I spent some time back home for a couple of years working in Wilmington, Delaware, but then I went back to New York for 10 years. And I worked at the New York Times. I worked at New York Newsday, and then I wound up at the Washington Post, which was kind of like the last kind of mainstream media outlet that I worked for. I left there, more than 10 years ago. I've been working for myself since then. But even though I'm working for myself, I'm still kind of contributing to, you know, media outlets. But they've been mainly black media outlets and trying to build my own media.
Yeah, well, I've seen you on, that's a contributor to Huffington Post, too?
I did do some contributing there, and I stopped. You know, I just kept running into conflict with them.
Yeah, couldn't take it.
Yeah, I kept running into conflict with them.
As they profess to be, right?
Exactly, you know, and you know, not progressive as they profess to be, but also I really felt, you know, I felt all those old things that I felt when I was still working in, you know, kind of like white mainstream media, is that they want to pretty much frame what blackness is,
right?
And they don't really want voices coming genuine voices coming from the community, from a black perspective. They wanna say what blackness is. And so when I saw that, I just like, okay, I can't do this anymore. And then after they had this, you know, multi-million dollar deal, I'm like, oh my God, you know, why are we, you know, contributing to this site for free? And, you know, they're running to the bank. So that was another element involved. You know, Huffington Post has all these free and these bloggers, people contributing, almost as a mission, because they wanted to create a site that was more progressive or whatever. And as it turns out, you know, Huffington, she's not sacrificing in that same kind of way. So I just thought that was just a real kind of a negative experience and kind of like not really a good place to expend my energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was a good way to let more people know about sameblack.com. You know, I mean, usually when I was contributing to something like that, I'd say, okay, I'm creating more outreach for us. They know more about the site. They did allow links. So, you know, that brought people back to our site. So, but, you know, it was kind of like a good situation.
It was a learning experience.
Exactly.
Now, where did you grow up in Philly?
I did.
No, I said where?
Oh, right near Temple in that little section called Yorktown.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm from Philly. Georgetown, with the Georgetown High.
Okay.
What prompted you to start seeing black?
Well, when I left the Washington Post, I told them I was going on a book leave, but I just didn't go back. And I spent some time doing some work for my son's volunteer work, actually, for my son's elementary school, trying to raise money for them. There's a public school around the corner, and I, you know, did the auction, you know, raised money for them that year. You know, we were proud. You know, we didn't raise the kind of, you know, big cash that these, you know, wealthy schools or wealthy areas raised. But, you know, I was proud that we raised what we did. I don't know, between $15,000 and $20,000. And during that process, I was trying to figure out what I really wanted to do, because I didn't want to go back to, you know, a newsroom. I didn't want to, you know, necessarily go into kind of like any other kind of, you know, TV or video per se at that time. So a friend told me about BET.com was starting at that time. The internet was just really starting to take off.
99, 2000.
Yeah, this is like, yeah. And so she said, you know, they need a film critic. And as it turns out, I knew the woman, Rita Hill, who was going to, you know, kind of be in charge of that whole project. She was their, you know, president, executive editor. I'm not sure exactly the title right now, but she was over building and maintaining that startup. And so she hired me. I really appreciated it. And she knew my work. I mean, I had lots of, you know, reviews that I had done at the Post and at Newsday. And so I had a pretty good clip file to show her. And so while I was, you know, contributing film reviews at the BET, I, you know, started to, you know, learn more about this new thing called the internet, or as someone told me at the time, the internet, you know. And so I saw what we had online in terms of, you know, black people, you know, that I could see, and I saw what BET.com had, and I really, really longed for a site that really kind of presented a fuller landscape or a picture of black cultural life beyond like the movies and hip hop. And so my initial idea was to do a lot of what I did when I was at the Post and when I was at Newsday, which was have a site where we had black critical voices on all of our arts, because I realized that even though we created a tremendous amount of art, my experience in the mainstream media was that our voices weren't there to write about it. And we did not have our own, weren't allowed our own critical voices about our own art and culture. You know, and it wasn't really against anybody. It was just more pro us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We should be able to write about our own culture, write about our own art, write about our own lives, you know, as an extension of that, you know, because who knows us better than us? I had a fellowship right when I was leaving Newsday. I had a whole year that I was able to spend at Columbia. I went back to Columbia, and I was in a program called the National Arts Journalism Fellowship. And it really allowed me to kind of crystallize my ideas about critical thinking and criticism. And, you know, I gravitated towards this theory of post-colonial theory, which really, I think, like, supported my idea about how we as people of color, not only here but around the world, you know, have, you know, not only a right but a kind of like a duty to kind of seize our own culture, our own experiences, and write about them from our own perspective, and not constantly be gazed upon and written about by others. So, you know, all these things were on my mind when I wanted to start the site. It's not that I didn't think that BET.com, you know, was incapable of that. It just had a different mission, and it was more pop culture oriented. And I was thankful for that, because I was thankful to be a contributor and to, you know, to be able to, you know, support me and my son.
Right. Uh-huh.
Right. I'm sorry?
No, I said, and get name recognition, too.
Right. So the initial idea for the site was really around culture, and this was in the beginning of 2001. And before we launched, I was working with a webmaster, a programmer named Jamila White, and I was working with her on the design and the concept, how it would look. And during that process, I realized that I wanted to be more than culture, that I wanted it to be, that I wanted it to have news. I wanted it to have things about health, issues, articles and discussions about health, wellness, spirituality. I wanted it to be just beyond art and culture. So, you know, what happened in September of that year, September 2001, and I was really glad at that point that we weren't just about art, you know, because things changed. Like, everything sped up really quickly, you know, after 9/11, and it became so important to be able to talk about, you know, politics and media and you know, all these other issues, news issues that, you know, arts would have allowed us to speak to indirectly, but having a news channel and all these other channels allowed us to address what was happening in the world directly. So that's what really led me to start it. I just, you know, I saw a lot of sites, and some of them had different elements of what I liked, but I wanted to try to have a site that had everything, you know, including, you know, blogs and message boards and just a place where there could be some discussion and community created, and which was seems progressive in tone as opposed to just, you know, what would be kind of like a typical mainstream presentation, which is center or more like this right wing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, after you started, I mean, did you run into any issues because you wanted to be open-ended and have a lot of input? There was a time when the government was cracking down on any criticism of their imperialist policies or their foreign policy. Did you run into any of that?
Right
in the belly of the beast.
Right. Well, and during that time, too, I mean, you know, I tell you a funny experience I had. I guess growing up in Philadelphia, you know, where I grew up, wasn't too far from, you know, where Frank Rizzo had the Black Panthers, like, stripped naked on Columbia Avenue. And I remember as a kid seeing this picture, I think it was in the Daily News. And
front page.
Right. And I remember, and when like a very progressive kind of organizer for Philadelphia. Like at that time, it was Mary Millie was still in Philadelphia, and you know there was, you know, I people who were very progressive who kind of, you know, without freaking me out, just let me know that, you know, your phone can be tapped, you know, that, you know, you can be watched. People can, you know, these things are real. These are people who actually experienced COINTELPRO, you know, like, you know, 20 years before. So they were just kind of schooling me about, like, you know, the ways of the real world, so that as an adult, I recognize this part of this country's history and the history of African Americans. And so I always assume that you know, they were definitely aware of, like, what's going on. Yeah, I just was at a demonstration, actually. It was a global day against military, military spending or something like that. And it was down at Lafayette Park in front of the White House. And you know, it's funny because I got into a point where I kind of know the CIA people, like, in the crowd. And so after I had to do my poem, I was kind of like walking around and like, you know, like checking out everything. And I said something to one of the other poets, and she kind of, like, you know, she kind of laughed about it. But, you know, I just think that, you know, I just assume all those things are happening. There was one morning when I answered the phone, and the woman asked me if this was Walter Reed Army General Hospital, because I don't live that far from there in D.C. And when I looked back on my caller ID, the call was from Halliburton. And I'm like, what is this all about? You know what I mean? Are they trying to, you know, because either a law or a proposed law where they could actually either set up the pretense for being able to tap your phone or follow you or whatever if you receive calls from, suspected terrorists or whatever. So I was thinking, you know, they could easily set a person up. They can say, oh, look, they got this call one morning, and this is where the call came from. And, you know, they could be calling you, you know. But anyway, I haven't really experienced any direct problems because of that. Because, you know, I think that coming out of being a part of the journalism world, like, all my adult life, I really lean very heavily on the First Amendment. And I almost really felt like, you know, if anything like that happened, I would definitely, you know, like, you know, get very quickly to the ACLU or wherever I had to go to get protection, because journalism is the fourth estate. We are the gatekeepers, the watchdogs of society, and you can't even have a so-called democracy without having the fourth estate, which keeps check on the other three estates, the executive, the judicial, and the legislative branch. And the problem is that the so-called fourth estate has gotten so in bed, you know, with the, I guess, the fifth estate, which is the corporations and the banks and Wall Street, that it's failing often to live up to its duty to tell the truth, to offer clarity about what is going on, and real news and information, as opposed to, you know, just
propaganda.
Yes, exactly. So I really, sometimes I talk to students and I do my media talk, and I realize that unlike a lot of my colleagues, who are probably a lot more jaded than me, or more like interested in making money than me, that I really absorbed all those lessons and all those classroom discussions about the media and the fourth estate, and that I really take it very seriously. You know, I really take it very seriously. So I'm not going to let, whatever powers that be, you know, try to thwart that because they think that, you know, let's just go pick on this black woman, you know, during this fight, because it's not just you know, one finger, you know, you have to band together to make a fist. So I haven't really had too many problems, and if I did, I would definitely, you know, raise a stink about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you offered a platform for multifaceted discussions, and so, you know, I found out about it. I think you contacted me, and I started contributing. So are you still in the market for contributors, writers?
Oh, absolutely.
How can people contact you? And first of all, give us the URL so people can go up there, those folks who may be not familiar.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's seeingblack.com. That's like seeing with your eyes, SEEINGBLACK.com. And I am definitely interested in, always interested in new contributors, people with ideas. And when I say contributors, not only for those who write, but those who have photographs or artwork or other things that they would like to contribute. Hopefully, when we finish our new format, we'll be able to have like our own little like video channel right there. And because so many people are so more video oriented than print oriented, that we'll be able to, you know, accept videos that people can contribute, and as well as audio pieces like what you're doing with your show. So I'm definitely interested, and they would just write me right at the website. My last name's Adairam, spelled I, V like Victor, E R E M like Mary. It's Adairam, I, V like Victor, E-R-E-M, like Mary, at seeingblack.com. So even if they can't remember my last name, if they go to the site and they click on Contact Us or About Us, they'll find a link, you know, for me, you know, and I receive all those emails. So.
Now, you just mentioned, because I was going to ask you, what are your plans for the site, because all the social networking, and the most popular are obviously Facebook and MySpace. But then you had a lot of people migrating to the Ning platforms before they went cross. And you can post your own videos, you can post your own photos, you can do the blog. So it would seem that in order to be competitive to that, even though they have changed and now they're not free like yours is, you have to move in that direction actually to
right to and you know, I actually expected the new site to be up by now, but I've unfortunately run into some issues with my young programmer designer, you know, someone who I had faith in to kind of see the project through. He's not kind of coming through as quickly, and I may have to shift gears and kind of start over, but definitely this year. And the new platform actually has all those links because we are on Facebook. There is a family of seeingblack.com on Facebook, and we're also, seeingblack is also on Twitter. So if people want to connect with me on Facebook or Twitter, I try to direct them to the page. A lot of people want to connect to my personal page, and this is okay because I try to direct them to seeingblack.com because the way Facebook does it, you have to set up a page, you have to also set up your own personal account. So I prefer to, you know, get people to connect with seeingblack.com on Facebook, and if they search it, it'll come up, and if they like us, then we'll be in their subscriber list, so they'll see all the posts and links for seeingblack.com show up on Facebook. And similarly, if they follow us on Twitter, they can either look up me or they can look up Seeing Black. I think Seeing Black is what it's under. They can follow us on Twitter, and they will get all our feeds every time I update the site or I send out a newsletter letting people know what we have up on the site. And also the new format will solve the problem for the contributors like you, the bloggers, because right now our message boards are kind of locked. And I had to lock them because of the spammers and the porn people. I couldn't just, like, leave them open for people to respond unless they were registered and I knew who they were, because the spam people and the porn people, a lot of them was coming from, like, Eastern Europe. I don't know why they picked my site. But they were just, like, going crazy on the site, and I had to clean up all that. So after I got it cleaned up, I said, I have to lock the boards, unfortunately. And it limits our sense of building community because people can't really respond the way I know they would like to. But I still, you know, I'm holding on, and I know that when we get our new format, it'll be better. And, you know, we can't let those kinds of things stop us or get in our way. Otherwise, you know, then you're defeated, right?
Right.
So, yeah. And I think it's important to have the space, even though the landscape of black websites has changed so much. I mean, you know, back then there was no Root, there was no Grio, there was no Atlanta Post, you know. And the thing about the Grio and the Root, of course, that's my old employer, the Washington Post, is that, you know, they're white corporate-owned sites.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at them, I see how there's definitely still a need for seeingblack.com, because we're going to put up articles and issues and voices that they would not do, that
yeah,
they won't do.
Right. Well, but remember early on in like around 2000 up to maybe 2001 until the dot-com bubble burst, you had what I call front websites that were owned by, you know, white Euro-American corporations, but they were just funded by black folks.
Yeah.
Okay, but it wasn't really genuine in terms of...
Which ones are you talking about?
I can't remember now because it was so long ago, but... I think one of them was owned by early on, I think it was AOL, and there was somebody else that owned.
Oh, yeah, but like Black Voices has always been out there, yeah. That's AOL now. I don't know if it was initially, because I remember meeting the editor of it, or the, you know, the manager. But I know that AOL purchased it. Initially, I think they had some kind of deal with one of the Chicago papers or something. But yeah, that's the kind of thing combined with AOL now. So now they're with my Huffington Post.
I understand that that merger sounds good, that partnership sounds good.
What is that?
The Huffington Post AOL merger, or AOL buying the Huffington Post. I thought I saw something the other day where it sounds good.
I'll have to double check that. I mean, as far as I know, that is definitely still very much a part of, you know, the whole deal, because she is over all of AOL's content now.
Oh, okay.
And,
you know, I saw there was a white group of news, alternative news people, was called the American News Project, and they used to put out their own stories. They did an excellent job. They merged with Huffington, and they just, I mean, I don't even know what happened. Happy.
to YouTube to get the traffic just to let people know you're out there.
Right. Exactly. And one of our other contributors, longtime contributors, Mark Anthony Neal, he has this pretty good show that he does out of Duke called Left of Black.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that I would like to include on our channel. On our channel once
right.
we get it up
right.
and running. So I see so much potential, and even when I get discouraged, because it's never been like a money making thing for me. It's like, you know, every now and then we've gotten like, you know, landed like some like one time contract, and we've met that, and we've tried to work with different services and stuff. And last year when LeBron left Cleveland, something happened where I don't know whether it was through Twitter or something, we got this like mound of traffic, and like, you know, because I had the Google ads up there, you know, it just like went way off the cliff, and you know, Google sent me this check, and I said, well, let me have them go to the bank. let me have them go to the bank with this check before they realize they made a mistake. And I went back to, but it's never been, yeah, it's never been that for me. It's really been a labor of love. But I think in more recent years, friends who are more entrepreneurial, because as a journalist, as a writer, as an artist, that really hasn't really been my main
right.
focus. I was able to kind of, you know, be a contributor elsewhere and kind of like make a living and then kind of keep seeing Black.com up as a labor of love. And I think in more recent years, friends who are more entrepreneurial have encouraged me to, you know, don't think of it that way, you know, try to make it work so that it can support itself. You know, so that it can be, because, you know, otherwise you'll just get burnt out and, you know, you'll just be frustrated at some point. So I do hope that the new format will allow us to, you know, have more traffic, to draw more people to us, and so that we can up our traffic and our advertising revenue and make it, you know, self-sustaining. You know, I'm not trying to like, you know, if it could just be self-sustaining, that would be great. And I think that's important for us to kind of respect our projects and our media and our voices and educate our own communities about how they can support us even if they don't have money. You know, I did something called the, and I'm still going to do it, called the homepage campaign. So everybody listening, if your homepage goes to Google or whenever you sign on, you go to Yahoo or whatever, reset your computer, your laptop, so that when you open up your browser, it goes to seeingblack.com. You know, there's, what, how many of us? 32 million? And if I got just a tenth of those people, or even, you know, I don't know, 1% of us to reset their homepage, seeingblack.com, that would just amazingly increase our traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that and help a black-owned site and not spend any money. And similarly, I try to tell people that very often advertisers want you to click on their ads. So if you make it your homepage and or, you know, click on the ads when you do visit, that helps a website tremendously, and it's not like we're asking you to, you know, be a paid subscriber.
Yeah.
Not that I don't mind a paid subscriber, but we have to be more savvy about the internet and how our clicks and our views of a site can make a big difference.
Well, that's true, and because the truth of the matter is that most of the folks who are doing it and who have longevity are doing it because it's a labor of love.
Right.
Otherwise, they get discouraged and stop.
Right.
But you mentioned your syndicated radio program on Pacifica, so what that state. Talk about that. How did you get into business?
Well, I guess I'm fortunate in New York and in D.C. to live in markets where Pacifica Radio exists. Now, in New York, there was BAI, and I just enjoyed a lot of their programs, very progressive. I think I first was familiar with Democracy Now! Through New York, And some of my friends, people I knew, either had shows there or, you know, they would be guests on shows. And, you know, I became familiar with a lot of, you know, kind of progressive voices through that station. And so when I moved to D.C., I was lucky that we have a Pacifica radio station here and WPFW. And I've been a listener for a lot of years, a supporter, you know, it's member supported, so, you know, you send in contributions, just like PBS or NPR or whatever, you know, people do. And so I had been a guest on, you know, some shows, but I've also been a contributor a few years ago to What's at Stake. Well, it wasn't What's at Stake at that point, but it was the same journalist, Verna Avery Brown. And, you know, we got to know each other pretty well, became friends, and at some point she wanted me to contribute culture, like movie reviews, culture items to the show, Kick, and so the show was just like the all politics and all news. And so I started doing that maybe about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago. And then eventually it turned into just co-hosting and producing, co-producing the whole show. So I've been doing that for about a year. It's also a labor of love.
Yeah.
And Pacifica, our station at least, is run by practically all volunteers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's very important because she has a you know, background in radio journalism, and she knows a lot of more about that technical side of that format than I do. And it's been great to actually learn something new. It's actually given me a whole new infusion of enthusiasm about journalism and the possibilities of it, because the fact is that a lot of people don't read, you know? A lot of people don't read, you know? You know the joke about, you know, if you want to keep something from a black person,
yeah,
put it in a book,
yeah,
you know? And they don't read, and so we listen to the radio, we watch TV. So as communicators, we have to be savvy and try to make our presence known in any media that we can. You know, every time we have a power outage, I'm reminded how vulnerable the internet is. You know, that not everybody, that all of a sudden, like, in a way, your media is gone. You know, like, no one can get to their computer, or if they have a mobile phone and the tower is down, they also can't call up the site.
Right.
So it makes me realize that, you know, whatever media we can be on, and that we can take advantage of, we need to be there. We need to do that. And you know, I've never had, you know, here in the Mid Atlantic, we have, you know, hurricanes, and, you know, I've never had so many power outages in my life. A few years ago, we had a hurricane. I can't remember, is it Isabel? And my power was out for 5 days. And
then you had the blizzard, too.
Yeah, yeah. And then last year, the power went out. And that was the first time it had gone out in the winter. So that created a whole new issue around the heat. And a lot of my neighbors left and went into hotels or whatever. But, you know, we have a fireplace and we have gas stoves. So we just kind of managed. You know, I wasn't going to, like, go to a hotel. I guess we just kind of, like, we knew how to rough it, you know?
Yeah, rough it out.
Right, we knew how to rough it. But my point is that, you know, I just realized that you know, something like a power outage just kind of takes away that voice or that media. So, and not all of us have computers, unfortunately. People don't talk about it, but very often they don't. But they have a TV or they have a radio. So if we can do something in a different media, we should do that. I mean, it's so, when you think about radio, and I know that there have been big changes in Philadelphia since I left, but when you think about radio, there's so few progressive voices on radio. I had the situation where I had to drive pretty regularly down to Atlanta a few years ago. My son was finishing school down there, finishing high school down there. I was going to his games on Friday night. And I was so aware that once I got past a certain point in Virginia, it was just like Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage,
country and western.
You know, there would be some gospel, you know, if I wanted to hear that. But in terms of voices, you know, it just turned into this right-wing harangue. And much of the country is like that, you know. So it's so important that if we can support progressive radio on the internet, on, you know, the regular broadcast waves, wherever it's coming from, it's really important to do that. Because,
question, does Pacifica Stream, can people get your show on the internet?
Yes, and the each station has their own website. So, for example, to listen to my show, they would go to WPSW.org. That's W, P like Paul, F like Frank, W.org. And my show is What's at Stake. It's on. They can listen live on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern time.
Mm-hmm.
But they can also go into the archives and listen to past shows. They've expanded the archive. They've improved it, but the shows don't stay up there forever.
Right.
They don't stay up forever. So one of the reasons why I would like to put the shows on SceneBack.com is because I would like to put them on YouTube, and so that they can stay forever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I can kind of create like an archive there of the different shows. Because we have some really good interviews with people, and you know, that information is still valuable, even though the show may be months old. You know, so.
Your latest book is called We Got a Habit, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006. It's published by DeCapo Press. How can people get copies of that and tell us about why you went to a book like that to talk about filmmaking and film and black images?
Oh, okay. Well, I have lots of the books. I mean, it's still in print, and if people shop on Amazon, they can certainly buy it there. If they want to support the author, they can, you know, they can send me $20 to the website address, which is 1750 Columbia Road, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20019. Just check on the website. If they send me $20 to the address, I will mail them a book. I guess I should include $3 for postage. So they save $23. I'll be happy to send them a book. And I'll sign it before I send it. They can also order it on Amazon if they're in the D.C. area. I know the book is at Bookstores and Poets. There are a number of bookstores that ordered it when it first came out. And I had some readings around the country, like in L.A. I had it at Esawan Books in down in Leimert Park. So if people are listening there, you know, and you can also order it from a bookstore. Like any bookstore that you like to go to patronize and support, you can always order a book. And you can order it by the title, We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, or look up my name and it should come up. And, well, you know, I really, when I left the Post, I had this idea to kind of create a book out of a lot of my essays that I had written on black culture. And that was also going to be called Seeing Black. And then I created the website and I did some other things. So at the point that I was thinking about the film book, to me it was still the same idea, to kind of collect a lot of things that I've written, but particularly on film, TV, media, video, that sort of thing, and put them together in a book. I wanted to mark 20 years after the Spike Lee's debut with She's Gotta Have It, and really kind of put something together that marked what we call the new wave of black film, which began with Spike Lee's debut and went on for at least a couple of decades. It's pretty much fizzled out now, but we had a pretty good age of film, black film, whether anything, but we had a time when Hollywood was giving black filmmakers a chance and to do some things, and then it kind of fell into the same Hollywood formula for the films.
Right.
But there was still an opportunity to do certain things that hadn't been done, you know, prior to 86, when we, you know, we saw an Eddie Murphy film, or we saw a Richard Pryor film, or we saw like something with Carl Weathers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we really didn't have, you know, our own voices out there in terms of movies and narratives. So that was really important to me, and I have had such a great time, you know, really giving talks and reading from the book and talking to people about movies. That is, you know, it's something when you get a group of people together. Typically, people have something to say about the movies, you know. And we have black people, we have a very strong connection to the movie. And we usually have something to say about movies we've seen, our images, you know, how we're portrayed, what it's saying about our lives. We have very strong, you know, we have very, you know, strong reactions to the movie. So I've had a great time, actually, talking to people, students, you know, groups of older people, whatever, you know, talking about the book, reading from the book, and talking to them about their experience going to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's been good.
Okay.
You know, and I hope to do that some more if anyone wants me to come talk to them. I'm in my car. I have gas in my car, and I can... Maybe I can get the people and speak to you. Just write to me at the site, and I'm
okay.
Glad to come. I will come.
Contact point at the site, and then we'll let you go because we're almost out of time.
Okay. My email is avarum@seeingblack.com. It's I, V like Victor, E-R, E-M like Mary, at seeingblack.com. That's the site, SEEINGBlack.com. And, if you don't remember my email, just go to the site and click on contact us, or one of the there's a couple different entry points for contact there, and I'll receive it. You know, I'll receive your email.
Okay. Well, thank you. I mean, I've been trying to get you for so long, and we just had a freak incident the other day when we just didn't connect, and this led to this. So all things work together, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. We'll have to get you on what's at stake also.
Okay.
All right. Because I know you have something provocative to say, whatever the subject is.
Well, you know how to contact me, so that's no problem.
All right. All right. Okay.
All right. I keep up the good work, and again, she is open to submission. Any kind of editorial restrictions or what?
It's so hard because, you know, I have really tried to maintain it as more of a family-oriented site. I don't do a lot of profanity or, things that, you know, I wouldn't want my child to be doing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of stray away from that kind of content. But I'm really open, and I really value our voices, so I try to make room for them.
Okay. All right, sister, we appreciate it, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, and you keep up the good work, too.
All right.
Okay.
All right, fine.
Cyberspace is a place that no army with artillery invades.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation
Nation Incorporated. No denomination, faith dominates, and no court is going to try.